Russia has the capacity to defend its strategic interests, and the Cold War never ended, is the opinion that M.J. Akbar, renowned author, journalist and thinker, has. In a conversation with me on this SNG podcast, he talked about how the lessons from the Russia-Ukraine war must wake up Europe, and how Ukraine may have walked into a trap which nobody realized. Go listen.
We are on the second anniversary of the Russian aggression, invasion, as the West describes it, or the special operations as Russia describes it. There's so many things have happened in the interim in these 2 years. What's your first thought when I ask you on the second anniversary of about that conflict itself?
Well, you know, a good starting point would be to map the first 3 months of the war with the last 3 months of the second anniversary, and you will get the story. Okay. Right? I think in the first 3 months, Ukraine had declared victory after the initial stumbles.
Sure, by Russia.
And of course, the cheerleaders of sitting in the Western capitals. I mean, I don't blame them. They have never been friendly to Russia. The Cold War was cold only in name. It was very, very warm in everywhere except Europe.
They
kept Europe sanitized.
And globe was the...
And the rest of the globe was on fire. I mean, whether it's Southeast Asia, Africa, where people have forgotten Angola, people have forgotten Latin America, they lit fires everywhere. And we paid a huge price for the so-called Cold War. So that war hasn't stopped. The collapse of the Soviet Union was one, one major event within the war, but it was not the end of the war.
You could call it a milestone or a pause, whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was a defining moment of the war.
Yes.
But it wasn't the end of the war because to the surprise of the West and its intellectuals and its academics, and the authors of, like Francis Fukuyama, who saw the end of history, this strange nation called Russia simply refused to surrender.
Yeah, or to roll over, yeah.
To roll over. I mean, you know, the Europeans sometimes just don't seem to get Russia, whether it's Mr. Napoleon trying to reach Moscow or whatever. No, Russia is not Europe. Only 1.5 or 2 time zones of Russia's 11 time zones are in Europe.
Absolutely.
It is a huge, Russia's real strength, economic strength, comes from Siberia.
Right.
Comes from, you know.
Far East. Yeah.
The Far East. I mean, that's one of the richest parts of the world. Absolutely. In terms of natural resources.
Sure.
So, I mean, if today's Russian economy is doing well, it is basically on the strength of those natural resources, which Russia is unlikely to surrender to another claimant in the region, yes, called China.
That, of course, is another battle.
Another story, yes. But don't forget 1969.
True. The Ussuri on the river, yeah, exactly.
It was about Manchuria, and it was about Siberia.
Sure.
And if you really go far back, then Siberia was the last or the easternmost of the Muslim Khanates.
Right.
It was the Khan of Sibr, which became corrupted into Siberia. Anyway, we are moving away from the point. The point is that the Russians have the capacity to defend their strategic interest, which has to be factored into, I think, Western thinking and the world's thinking. Those who underestimate Russia, the Germans, were the last ones to do so. Right. They reached Moscow. People have reached Moscow. And then returned.
Absolutely. Empty-handed and defeated.
And with scars,
yes,
which they don't forget. So I think, now if you want me to suggest, unless you are asking another question, the turning point of the war,
right.
Then I would take you back. I forget the specific time.
Yeah.
But there was a televised conference,
right,
which Putin held. It was a conference, not a press conference.
No.
It was a conference that he held with his ministers and with his defense production team.
Right. Yes, I remember that.
You remember that?
Yes, I remember that.
In which he publicly berated them.
Yeah.
I mean, I could virtually see one deputy minister shaking, or something, literally
yes, yeah,
shaking.
Absolutely.
Because Putin understood that war cannot be conducted without defense production.
Absolutely.
You know, famously, I think Napoleon said, an army marches on its stomach, but an army battles with bullets.
Absolutely. Munitions is the most important part of...
The quartermaster general.
Yes, exactly.
In any...
right,
and if that section fails, then you really are running on empty.
Right.
Ukraine's problem is that it has developed, and I say this without prejudice, it has developed a reputation for wasting ammunition at a rate which its friends, the burn rate,
right,
its friends consider unacceptable, you know, but this happens when you get things free.
Yes, and that's exactly the point that what you're trying to make is, while Russia has ramped up its production, it's got its act together after the first few stumbles, the Ukrainians, on the other hand, are dependent on supplies from friends and allies, or friends and benefactors, if I want to call the U.S. that. And they have not been able to keep pace, because the industrial capability in Europe, as you would know better than anybody else, has degraded over the years, over decades.
The industrial capability of Germany, Nitin, is vibrant. It's, you know, among the best in the world.
Okay, military industrial capability,
yes. The Europe is now, as we say, to use a phrase, the chickens are coming home to roost. For 70 years, you thought that you could outsource your military requirements to America.
Absolutely.
This is what Trump said.
Right. Yeah. 70% of the supplies come from America.
Only 70%. The spending comes from
America. Yes.
Right. Comes from America. Yeah. The Europeans have not been able to put 3% of their GDP into the defense budget. So they have nothing there to play with. Nothing. There is no flexibility.
Absolutely.
If you look, some of the statements made by the German, they're saying, you know, and Angela Merkel is lauded as some great... Today, nobody talks about her.
Right.
Because she degraded German military ability at an astonishing pace under her watch. And they all bought economic growth by transferring these funds into investment. So, okay, they did it. But, therefore, they now don't have answers.
Absolutely.
Right?
So,
don't ever forget, I mean, since the subject is about Russia, I'm reminded of famous lines from Moscow. Remember that famous line, Stalin, when told that the Pope didn't approve X or Y or thing that he had done, he says, how many divisions does a Pope have?
That's true, of course. I mean, military capability is the essence of any nation's, you know, rise or fall in that sense. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they look at our own situation. You know, we have strengthened our military capability in the last 10 years, not because we want to invade anyone, but to secure our own frontiers.
It's a deterrence.
It's a deterrence.
Yeah,
everybody knows that all defense is deterrence. The age of invasions and conquests basically is unacceptable in the era of the nation state. We are not in the era of empires, right? Therefore, if invasion is off the books, but the fear of conflict arising out of different viewpoints on what a border is has not gone. And certainly, certain assertions that may be strategic, that may be expanding areas of influence and so on and so forth, require deterrence and require capability.
Yes. So that brings me to UK's role, for instance, because in Europe, apart from you know, the European Union, and the UK has been trying to sort of back Ukraine, at least publicly. And I heard some of the UK analysts talking about how Ukrainian fighters are resilient, Ukraine is resilient, and Russia better watch out. So, your views on what UK brings to the table, really?
I think Britain is now become a Humpty Dumpty of the world, at least in strategic affairs, right? It's sitting on a wall, waiting for war to fall. But then what is there to fall? Because, I mean, it's appalling. I mean, deeply embarrassing. I think not a single UK strategist should be showing their face at this moment after what happened to the Trident.
Right.
I mean, here you're in Cape Canaveral.
Yes.
On HMS Vanguard, right. One of your, which itself has come out after 7.5 years of a refit.
Absolutely.
Right? You don't have ships. I've just written a piece which I've headlined, you know, Britain, you know, Britannia used to rule the waves. Today, Britannia fools the waves.
And that's a way, it's a very good way to put it, yes.
Because, I mean, they can't, a nuclear missile test launch, which just goes up and plops a few yards in front of you.
It's a massive embarrassment and a dangerous thing to happen, really.
It's a very dangerous thing
exactly.
to happen, you know. I can imagine these analysts who keep wandering around on somebody else's money. You know,
yes.
If this had happened in some country in the third world, let's say
in India,
they would have laughed, you know, kind of. Today they are. Today it has gone into the deep cupboard called secrets, official secrets, right? But I mean, thankfully, British media is still vibrant, and the Sun broke the story. They wanted to hide it. That's this happened on 30th January,
absolutely.
3 weeks. But it's absolutely extraordinary. I very interestingly, as we are talking about this morning, I'm reading in the Times London that what British really is really building is decoy and fake weapons.
Oh, my God. So just a deception, basically.
So that, you know, they can sort of draw the enemy fire. I mean,
which is what a come down from what it was in those days.
Everybody's a
Not anymore. Yeah, exactly. And look at Ukraine's, talking about Ukraine's resilience that they keep touting about. I read somewhere and I heard an American analyst talking about it, that the average age of a Ukrainian fighter on the front lines is now in the mid-40s somewhere.
And the outside age, average is, you know, it's a median of two sides.
Right.
People above 60s.
So how are they going to sustain that?
And they can't get troops. Their young people are fighting away. The morale is gone.
Yes.
Right? I don't know, but I'm not going to get into cause and so on. Be that as it may, Russia has put its case that it cannot permit the NATO embrace to go beyond a point. That is its defining line, which has been well known to everyone. There has been an implicit respect of that line for so long.
Absolutely.
And I think sometimes when you get immature leadership on the other side, or leadership which is pumped up by your benefactors into believing what you're not. Ukraine also is not the healthiest story of, corruption, for example, is huge. And there have been huge complaints that many of the weapons have been...
The generals had to be changed. The leaders in the military had to be changed. Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Apart from the latest one. So, there is a lot of murk around it. Right? But basic reality is that Ukraine, I think the army, the people have lost their morale. They lost their base. They may genuinely believe that this is their territory and they want to defend their land. They're perfectly entitled to. But the thing is that belief is one thing. The ability to implement that belief and defend that belief is quite another.
So that brings me to the United States. The Americans have been at the forefront of initially, you know, pumping up or even propping up Ukraine. And they thought this is going to be a trap for Russia. Now analysts in U.S., conservative analysts, okay, admittedly Republicans, are talking about how U.S. has got distracted from its primary theater of concern, which is the Indo-Pacific, especially Taiwan. You believe that U.S. is now fighting too many battles at the same time and does not have the capability of sustaining any one of them?
First, why should we believe that the converts are not patriots? And they have a very good understanding of what their nation's priorities are and so on. And, you know, it's not simply one element in a certain part of geography of United States which has the right of comprehensive analysis.
Yeah.
Right? So, and they have a point. They have a point in terms of... now, let us be very clear about one thing, that the Americans have the money, they have the technology, they have the defense capability by far, which is beyond anyone else's, right? And if required, they have the capacity to fight everywhere. But I think after Iraq in particular, they have also learned that they don't have the capacity to win everywhere.
Right. They can go everywhere, but they may not be able to go anywhere.
After Afghanistan and Iraq, right, to be able to, right? Today, the Houthis may be only a mosquito bite, but a mosquito bite can leave malaria.
Of course.
Right. One of the more interesting things, we heard that one of the missiles that the Houthis fired was an Israeli Eilat missile. So we don't know what is happening in, as I said, the murky world of arms transfers and arms sales.
Where will you get leaked and where,
you know, who is smuggling what,
right,
from where?
Mm.
I'm not for a minute suggesting that Israel is doing this, but the black market is black for, you know, I wish they didn't call it black. It's a dark market.
Yeah, market, and it doesn't distinguish
sides
in that sense.
So... the Houthis are showing that, you know, if they just stop shipping in the Gulf of Aden, the prices of everything in the world eventually in 6 months, 7 months, 10 months, you're adding 3,000 miles to trade. So, and, you know, the other thing, point you must absolutely, I think this is of the highest importance. We'll come to Taiwan later.
No.
How far is the West Asia war from the Ukraine war?
Correct.
Please look at geography.
Exactly. We have to look at the map.
All you have to do is north of Syria is what? Is the Caucasus.
Sure, sure.
And the Caucasus are the Black Sea,
yes,
and the Crimean region. Crimea is with Russia, right? Crimea is the claimant. I mean, Ukraine is next door. So this conflagration, this is a very dangerous, I don't call it a prairie fire because a prairie fire is supposed to be small, but these are huge prairie fires.
Yes. Multiple prairie fires, maybe.
Exactly. And when they will link up, we don't know. War doesn't respect boundaries. And there are very serious dangers if people who are supervising the and understanding the consequences of these wars don't realize how quickly this can become a genuine world war.
But I need to ask you one final question on Iran or Iran's role in all this, because there is a feeling...
Just
yeah, sure.
One point.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, since I don't want to avoid the East Asia.
Sure.
Taiwan,
yes.
The Americans... will not ever relax or compromise on their complete domination of the Pacific.
Right.
And I think the Chinese also
know that,
need to know it. And nobody should have illusions about it.
Yeah.
The China may be a rising power, fully risen or half risen or quasi risen, I don't know. But it hasn't risen enough to take on America and the Pacific.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I wanted
technology itself.
Yeah, exactly. They're far ahead. Even their defense budget is three times the Chinese.
Defense budgets you can squander.
Yes, exactly.
Technology.
Innovation, technology, critical and emerging technologies, they're far ahead. I think that's a given, I think, and we should not forget that, certainly.
And we should not underestimate Russian technology.
Neither should we. They're more rugged. They may not be as glamorous as the Americans, but...
Iran.
I was coming to that. So,
Chahid,
of course, and how Iran
and Zulfiqar.
Correct. And see, look at the way Iran, China, and Russia are now teaming up.
Application.
Exactly.
On this alliance.
That's right. So I was coming to Iran, particularly because now there is a feeling in the region, West Asia, as well as in Europe now, that Iran is now driving multiple proxies, Hezbollah, Houthis, their own technology or their own weaponry or platforms that they're giving to Russia, and they want to give it to anybody, they will take it. So where does Iran figure in all this? And our relationship with Iran is far different than anybody else's. So these two parts.
Our relationship with Iran really is one of the standalone relationships of world affairs. It has survived the test of decades. Right? Never forget that when, and forget the year, and I hope I'm not making a mistake, but if I remember correctly, Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee went for a day at a time when Iran was under very severe sanctions
pressure,
and so on and so forth. Just as a gesture that irrespective of everything, irrespective of our relations with the West, which are very good, irrespective of our relations with America, which are excellent, right? This is a relationship which we are ready to preserve and do all that is necessary to preserve that relationship, and which is an extremely good thing. You know, I remember one Iranian, the Iranians, when they want to say something a little salty, they do it with a beautiful smile.
Yeah, well, I think they are a different breed altogether.
Yeah, completely. Civilizational reality.
I was just going to say that because one of the Iranian diplomats said this, that we have a civilizational connect which nobody else can understand. Yeah.
So the Iranians, I remember telling me and mentioning, he said, this was some years ago, but I'm sure the syndrome hasn't changed. He says, look, the difference is this. Well, Pakistan and I, we are brothers. Iran, Pakistan, next door. All right, we are Shia, they are Sunni, but right, we have no problem, except over Balochistan.
Exactly. Which again is
Iran. Right. But they turned around and said, but listen, when India and Iran disagree, or when you disagree with us, he's referring to Iran. When you differ, we know that you differ with us because of the Indian national interest. When Pakistan differs with us, we know it is under instructions from someone else.
Which I think they understand that autonomy, the strategic autonomy that we call it.
Understand yes. India is an independent right. nation and no two nations will agree on everything.
Correct.
Yeah, I should say. Right. But they know which is a puppet nation and which one is an independent nation. And that really is the strength of our relationship.
Yeah, it's a good base to start off with. But My point about...
Now these proxies.
Yes.
Iran has built up, right, a multi-front axis and has been doing so for some time. If you look at the Iranian revolution now, over 50 years,
4 years later, 5 years later, it will be like that. Yeah.
79. What did they begin? Then they went through 8 years of a war with Iraq. So they have understood that their enemies also fight through proxies.
Right.
At least this is their belief.
Correct.
So there is no reason why they should not utilize similar strategic methodologies.
Yes.
And also, Iran is, we think of it as an isolated Shia. In my book, Shade of Sword,
yes.
I had done a long chapter on the arc. Which is the Shia arc, which is basically, if you look at Shia populations, right. not Shia nations, then you get from sort of west of Mazar-e-Sharif, right, into Iran.
Yeah.
Into Iran, from Iran, Iraq
yes.
is a majority Shia country. So, you know, it's one of those anomalies of history
yes.
that from 1400 years, mainly they have been Sunni, largely. Sunni rulers, but it's a Shia majority country. The moment you release Iraq from autocracy and make it a democracy, the majority rule will come in. So it extends space, right? Not completely. Maybe it's a gray space, but there. Now, in Syria, the population may be Sunni, but
the rulers are again that's right.
It's one of the Shia denominations.
Right.
And then up to Hezbollah.
Yes.
Now, Hezbollah, everybody automatically thinks, and correctly so, that it's one of the confrontation points for Israel.
Right.
But it's not simply that. Hezbollah is also an Iranian ally on the Mediterranean, which is very important, has been from the time of Darius and Xerxes and so on, and the wars with Greece.
Correct.
So they don't forget, and there is continuity in their thinking. Right, and for a long while, those great rulers of Iran, he ruled up to the Indus.
Right.
So they have a sense. Of course, they don't look east that much anymore.
No, because,
but so they have used proxies, and they have developed them and developed their capability. The Wahhabi is once a joke. But they fought back for a year, 10 years against in the region enemies. So, I mean, they have done what they have done.
Okay. So, that's why this whole, the region now looks so aflame with various possibilities and, uncertainties there. But we'll see what happens. But this was an important conversation I wanted to have with you. On the second anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine war, we, of course, traversed half the globe in discussing this. But it's a masterclass, and I must thank you for giving us this sense of history and connecting it with the present. And that's something that our viewers need to know, and that's why this conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, Nitin.